Hey, Political Theory Review listeners. My name is Jenna Spinelli, and before we get to this week's episode, I want to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy. It's called Democracy Works, and it's a show that examines what it means to live in a democracy, everything from immigration to demagoguery to gerrymandering. I'm one of the show's hosts, along with Chris Beam, who is this week's guest on the Political Theory Review. Some of our previous episodes include a discussion on neoliberalism with Wendy Brown and a conversation about the psychological foundations of democracy with Jonathan Haidt. New episodes of Democracy Works are released every Monday. You can find the show at democracyworkspodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you, and we hope you'll check it out.
I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I am talking to Christopher Beam, Managing Director of the McCourtney Institute for Democracy and Assistant Research Professor in the Department of Political Science at Penn State University. We're discussing his book, Democratic Humility, Reinhold Niebuhr, Neuroscience, and America's Political Crisis, out in paperback in 2019. Beam works on democratic theory, is the author of five books, and co-hosts the podcast Democracy Works. So first of all, Chris Beam, let me say welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Well, thanks. I appreciate the time. I'm happy to be here.
Chris, thanks so much for the book, Democratic Humility, which confronts some of the major problems in American democracy today, the problem of polarization. And you do it in a particularly interesting way through an analysis of Reinhold Niebuhr and through bringing in lots of social and even natural science. And you're also the co-host of the Democracy Works podcast, which is a great podcast. So I would say that you're saving democracy in a couple of ways. So kudos.
Doing my part. Yeah. The way things are right now is we say it's a full employment act for people studying democracy.
Okay, good. Yeah. So maybe you could start by, I ask all the authors to say a little bit about the motivation for writing the book. You have a lot to say about that in the introduction, but maybe you could sort of set the stage there.
Well, okay. I mean, so I just started reading on my own a lot of this neuroscience literature. And I have no background. I claim no expertise except for having read a lot of these books. But I can say that a lot of the literature is written for a layperson. And I just find it just so interesting. And so much of this data is, you know, especially with the fMRI and things like that, functional magnetic resonance imaging, is new data, you know, and actually seeing pictures of the brain thinking in action. I mean, and it's just so interesting to me. And as I was reading some of these works, and a variety of perspectives on, you know, how self-righteous we are, how self-important we are, how we all think we're above average, and despite the fact that we don't have a lot of, objective evidence for thinking that about some things, and how inescapable our biases are, and how we are inevitably looking at the world in ways that conform to how we want the world to be, as opposed to how we think the world is, or how the world actually is. And so I'm reading all this stuff, and it just occurs to me that it reminds me of Reinhold Niebuhr and this kind of hard-headed realism about the human condition and about ourselves, and a lot of that obviously comes from his Christian, you know, kind of frame of reference. And my PhD is actually from the UFC, University of Chicago Divinity School in Ethics and Society, and so I had a pretty good background in that. And so, you know, I honestly, I can recall the day when I went into my library and got all these Niebuhr books down and started working on them. I'm like, yeah, there really is a connection here. And so, you know, to bring this question in for a landing. I think it's fair to say that the perspective of science is very similar to the Christian perspective on sin, the Christian or the scientific perspective on the human inclination to bias is very similar to the Christian concept of sin, which is to say, it's universal, it's inescapable, and it causes us to think less of ourselves. And so, once you get that, then the idea of kind of applying it to the contemporary context of our democracy, just made sense to me. And anyway, so, you know, I mean, it's a very synthetic book. It puts together a bunch of stuff that doesn't normally go together. But I do think it offers at least a perspective on where we are as a democracy and what we do about it.
The book is framed, I mean, that you sort of marshal Niebuhr and the sciences in order to respond to a kind of crisis of our times. This is a kind of crisis of our times books, which I study the German, so I the crisis of our times is I'm used to. In any case, maybe you could say a little bit about your assessment of the problems with contemporary democracy. I think that's a sort of good place to begin, because you focus on the sort of polarization or tribalism, which has become even, I mean, you wrote the book in 2014, 2015. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it strikes me that some of the things that you say have been just exacerbated in the last couple of years. So maybe we could say a little bit about the kinds of problems that you see.
No, I the book was written, pre-Trump, pre-2016 election. And yeah, I do think that there is no reason to think that the conditions that I wrote about have gotten better. So I think there are some endemic features of human behavior, human proclivities that are not going to go away. They're always there. But I think in the contemporary climate, those proclivities are not only not constrained by our society, they're given free rein by the society. So our innate desire to be tribalistic is reinforced and celebrated by the kind of media climate we have now, and the fact that we all have this opportunity, and in the case of algorithms, are kind of driven towards media news perspectives that reinforce our point of view. And in a democracy, the premise of a democracy is that we are going to disagree, that faction, in Madison's terms, is inevitable and inescapable. And so if a democracy is going to operate well, we have to develop the means for engaging arguments and points of view that we don't agree with. And we have to learn how to fight fair with regards to those disagreements. And the contemporary climate, you know, with regards to cable TV, talk radio, a variety of other media, all foster these kind of epistemological cocoons, and our brains prefer that, right? I mean, when we hear that we are the good guys and that we are the good Americans, the moral people, the ones who are actually in touch with reality, we get a shot of dopamine when we hear that. And so there's something, it's a very, very good business model that that Fox News and Ann Coulter's of the world have created. And on the left, you know, you have some of this too, although it's not as strong. But because of that, I think it is undermined any potential for us to kind of to come together to address these issues collaboratively, competitively, and you know, there's a lot of good political science data about the hollowing out of the middle, and there's a lot of historical reasons for that. Obviously, you know, Lyndon Johnson signing the Civil Rights Bill, and you know what he ostensibly said about losing the South for a generation. I mean, all of that is true as well. And I don't have any interest in, you know, kind of laying out the variables and figuring out which one is the most relevant or, you know, important. But I do think it's absolutely clear that the media climate has made it harder for us to operate as a democracy.
Yeah, a lot of political science, social science literature has looked at this issue of polarization, the rise of tribalism and contemporary American democracy, and yeah, offered a number of different explanations for its development. I mean, one of the, I think, you know, distinctive things about your book is that you really drive down to something quite basic and account for, I think, one of the basic explanations for why it is, which is, you know, what is it about our basic psychologies, our human nature that inclines us in the direction of tribalism, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Thanks. That's, I mean, I think that is something that I wanted to do, and something that I think, you know, changes our perspective on democracy. I mean, as a way of organizing our lives, shared lives together, right? If that we ought to understand it as something that is maybe harder than we thought it was, and something that, you know, we can't just push a button and let it run, you know, that we have to continually work to develop a set of habits and dispositions that don't come easily or naturally.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, you might say that the views of human nature that had developed in the 20th century were maybe a bit too optimistic. There was a bit, you know, we had a kind of a sunnier view of human nature, that the sky's the limit and we can sort of develop, perfect ourselves, perfect our natures in the, you know, in the 60s and in the wake of the second half of the 20th century. And Reinhold Niebuhr has quite a different view of that. It's a, you know, in some ways a kind of classical liberal view of the inherent limits or inherent flaws of our nature. So you sort of been sketching the view that maybe you could say a little bit about, you know, his view of the children of light and the children of darkness, and how that sort of illuminates our human nature.
I'll try. I mean, it's obviously part of a big corpus, right? And so, you know, I'll just kind of, you know, skirt around the edges. But, you know, Niebuhr is a Christian, right? And he's working in Christian categories. But he's not talking just to Christians. He's talking to everyone. And actually, there was a group in Harvard, Arthur Schlesinger and others, who called themselves atheists for Niebuhr because they thought he gave the most compelling realist foundation for, what you know, international politics. But So his argument is, Niebuhr's argument is that Christianity makes the most sense of the most facts. And he starts with just a basic anthropology. And the basic anthropology is that human beings are anxious. They're anxious about the fact that we're all going to die, and the fact that we aren't as powerful, that we know how precarious our existence is. And so this anxiousness for a Christian is what drives you to sin. But for all of us, you know, Christians and non-Christians, this anxiety drives us to have to find ways to mollify our sense of anxiety. And so we develop a stronger, inordinate sense of our own importance, our own value, our own standing in the world. And he says we're telling ourselves lies. And that's the beginning of sin, but it's also what we need to do to get ourselves out of bed in the morning and get on with our lives. There's actually, what's his name? Palchinski, I think. Anyway, he developed this terror management theory, and he says that his data show that it's if we actually really understood and accepted the idea that our existence is as meaningful as lima beans, that it would be difficult for us to be in a position to pass on our genes. So it's a very good evolutionary strategy for us to deny that reality. Anyway, so that's just as a kind of background of where Niebuhr sees, what Niebuhr sees as a foundation for human anthropology. There's more to it than that. I mean, and it's not all negative, right? We're also, what he would say is children of God. But, and so there's also this kind of inherent desire to do the right thing. But so with regards to children of light, children of darkness, the children of darkness are the ones that understand this reality. They understand that human beings are anxious, and they want to hear people tell them that they don't have to be anxious, and that you are part of a group that is extremely successful, and often you are blessed in the eyes of God, right? You are doing what God wants you to do, and therefore you feel better about yourself. Again, the child of darkness doesn't believe this, but the child of darkness knows that human beings want to hear it. And so they tell people and frame their arguments in this way so that people follow them. The child of light is the person who is naive with respect to these human realities. So the child of light thinks that this human problem of anxiety, of sin, of conflict, these problems are solvable one way or another, right? So communism thinks, or thought probably is more accurate now, that the dictatorship of the proletariat would create the classless state and history would end. And liberals believe that, if we bring up, if everyone is educated sufficiently, we won't have conflict. And so they create this vision of society that basically solves these human problems. Niebuhr is particularly interested in the social gospel movement of the early 20th century. And, it's not that he doesn't find the vision appealing. It's the idea that we're going to create basically the kingdom of God on earth. And Niebuhr says, it's not that that's not a good vision, but it's not possible. And not only, and by creating a vision that is impossible, you open the door for the child of darkness. So Marxism inevitably leads to Lenin, and the kind of liberal vision of the 18th century leads to Napoleon, etc. And so there is no, this is kind of a Scylla and Charybdis for anyone who's thinking politically. And there's danger on both ends, and there's a kind of, it's very difficult to keep both of these extremes out of politics. But he thinks that is the best way to create a politics that works.
Yeah, let me follow up on Niebuhr's view of human nature, because it's quite interesting. I mean, so the basic the sort of foundational emotion for Niebuhr is a sense of anxiety, as you say. I mean, it's so particularly an anxiety about death. In this way, you know, Niebuhr is similar to Hobbes. I mean, Hobbes, who starts the early modern tradition with turning against the ancients and positing a single summum malum that sort of animates human beings, the fear of death. Although it seems to be a little bit different of an analysis from Hobbes. I mean, Hobbes has a sense of, you know, the anxiety about death drives us to accumulate power. Mm-hmm. here and that, and then to become powerful. I mean, so there is maybe perhaps a similarity there with Niebuhr, but the your allusion there to the terror management theory from psychology suggests slightly different, which is not that we accumulate power here and now, but we in somehow can beat death, right? By connecting ourselves with an identity that will long outlive us, right? That we become part of a church, or we become part of a group that outlives us, right?
Right, right. So, all right, let me just bracket that, because I think your point is really interesting, and it actually makes me think that that the connection to Hobbes is even stronger than you might think, because Niebuhr says that this anxiety is what drives human creativity, right? So we can't change nature, we can't change reality, but we can modify the conditions under which we live. And so the same anxiety that causes us to sin is also what drives us to improve our existence. And he also says that that inseparable from this anxiety is the will to power. So yeah, I think it's a very kind of Hobbesian point of view. I hadn't really thought about that before, but yeah, I think that's a really good kind of frame of reference.
It might help. I mean, because one of the things I was curious about too is how a kind of common emotion of anxiety could branch itself off into two very different dispositions towards that, you know, the children of light and the children of darkness, but it could just be two different ways to exert that will to power, right? If the children of light sort of exert it through, through a kind of belonging to a group that exerts more power, whereas the children of darkness can, sort of operate at the margins of this group, you know, manipulate the groups and it play on our tendency towards a kind of tribalism.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I also think that that the tribalism is just as operative in, if not more so, among children of darkness. So, you know, Niebuhr's writing this at the very tail, the children of light, children of darkness. He wrote it right at the tail end of World War II. So, obviously, you know, Exhibit A in this regard is the Nazis, right, and Hitler, and just how. You know, on the one hand, you know, ruthless and, you know, without any, you know, concern about making the world better. It's a raw will to power, but it's also, you know, you think about, you know, the real genius of Nazis in terms of developing this kind of tribalistic, you know, you are part of something great and full of majesty, and you are the best human beings there are, and therefore it's completely, anything you do is completely legitimate, and there is meaning, purpose, and creativity that comes from that.
Yeah, I guess then I don't see how that isn't a children of light. I mean, I can understand nobody wants to put the Nazis in the camp of the children of light. It seems seems kind of perverse in a way. But they, I mean, you think about contemporary democracy. People were talking about the rise of white supremacy. I mean, you know, in a way, you see this as a sort of same, you know, the operable, you know, under the same similar analysis, which is you have a group of people here who you know, who are tribalistic, who invest their own group with a certain kind of virtue and goodness, and they think that they're the ones that are bringing civilization to amidst barbarism and so forth. I mean, so it's, you know, I guess I had thought that the Children of Darkness was much more like a kind of hard-nosed realist Machiavellianism, but maybe I just don't know Niebuhr all that well.
You know, here. I think the distinction is that a Child of Darkness is, you know, completely is concerned solely with winning, and a Child of Light is interested in solving the problems of human existence for all of us, you know, for literally bringing history in some sense to an end. And but it's also true that, you know, as I mentioned, that there is, because the theories of, or the goals of a Child of Light are, you know, fundamentally unrealistic, that makes it more likely that they are going to at some point degenerate into some kind of dark version of it, vision of itself. And so, I mean, while I don't think, you know, I can't think of any kind of Children of Light Nazi, you know, I think it is, you know, fair to say that, you know, the Marxian vision is a lot better than the Leninist reality, the Stalinist reality. And so that, I think, is one way to kind of keep them separate. But I also think it is true that these are, you know, these are both perversions of reality. It's just that the Child of Darkness is more connected to, you know, how human beings actually operate.
Yeah. Okay. So I think maybe I'll summarize this back to you, because I think I'm getting it. So it's human beings are fundamentally beset by anxiety about our finitude, and one reaction to that is the Children of Light, which is animated by a desire to overcome our finitude, right? That is to find some end of history, or to find some sort of sense of meaning or purpose that will defeat those, ameliorate that basic anxiety. And the problem with that is that our finitude is inescapable. Is that it? Or there are just going to be multiple different accounts or multiple different competing Children of Light that can conflict with one another?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea is that there is the idea that conflict, you know, that we can solve, we you know, look, nobody has put forward the idea or a philosophy that's going to solve the problem of death, right? Mm-hmm. but you can solve the problem of, or you can ostensibly claim to solve the problem of want, right? Or of conflict. And that is what the Child of Light strives to do, or the kind of notion that they put forward. And, a Child of Darkness doesn't. They're not interested in solving that problem. They're interested in solving it for themselves, or, you know, and addressing the issue of anxiety for themselves and their group.
Yeah, good. And so, I mean, this quite interesting view of human nature you argue is backed up. This is a sort of surprising turn in the book, but you already mentioned it, sort of backed up by a massive amount of literature in the social sciences, particularly in psychology and in neuroscience. I don't know if you want to pick any. I mean, you have a lot of great examples of experiments that individuals have done to sort of illustrate this view. I don't know if you want to pick any to recount for us, but
yeah, it's hard to pick one. I think The one that that I have used before and that I, you know, it really is remarkable is I'm blanking on his name. It's Drew Wesson. That's it. And he had this was in the John Kerry, George W. Bush campaign. And he chose 30 men, I think, of both parties who were strong supporters of Kerry and Bush. And he gave them scenarios that were false, but they were completely plausible. And he's, you know, they're hooked up to the machine while he's doing this. And the scenarios show that their candidate was inconsistent and that they were shown to be, you know, saying something that either was false or was a mischaracterization. And they showed parts of their brain lighting up that were associated with discomfort. Now, I need to say, and I do in the book too, that you know, you can only learn so much from an fMRI, right? It's still orders down from the level of one neuron firing. You know, it's showing where the blood is going in the brain, and you know, the blood is needed to get the energy and the potassium, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, whatever. But it is still information about how the brain is acting in real time. So when they saw this inconsistency, they were feeling discomfort. Whether it was conscious or not, the brain was registering discomfort. And then they were asked, you know, what do you think about this? And as they talked about it and came up with an explanation as to why this wasn't as bad as it sounded, or why it seemed to be, why it was just an apparent contradiction and not a real one, their brain produced dopamine. Or at least the pleasure centers of their brain lit up. So the process of feeling like your candidate was not doing well caused you discomfort, and your brain's effort to discount that reality and come up with explanations for it made you feel better. And this is a matter of chemicals, and it's a matter of your brain operating in ways that you're not even aware of. And this happened to Democrats and Republicans at almost precisely the same level. So the point is that we identify with our party, with our candidate, with the candidate's values, and when that candidate does well, we feel good. When the candidate doesn't do well, we feel discomfort, and our brains work to make sure that discomfort doesn't continue.
Yeah.
And most of this, if not all of this, happens underneath and inaccessible to our conscious selves.
Yeah. Yeah. This is interesting. I mean, you connect much of the literature that you cite to a, you know, sort of broader evolutionary psychological account of, you know, the development of human beings as a tribal species, right? That we sort of evolved to have a tribal consciousness or a connection, an identification with our tribe in order to pass on our genes. And so a lot of the sort of psychological quirks that we see, you know, motivated reasoning above all else, is connected to our sort of tribal nature, that we feel pain when our tribe is harmed, and we distort our reasoning in order to support our tribe, and so forth and so on. And so the modern age has attempted to find ways to overcome this sort of biases in our reasoning. But you know, one of the problems is a lot of contemporary developments in American democracy have reinforced that tribalism, particularly the media, which you talk about a lot. I don't know if you want to move to the media or say anything more about the sort of tribal nature.
The tribalism stuff is interesting to me. This is not so much a new development. Some of this, the real classic experiment that I cite from Muzaffar Sharif took place in the 50s, I think, where he took these two groups of boys and just sent them off in this camp and just found how, objective or predisposed reason, these boys developed themselves into groups where they were strongly identified with their own group and strongly negatively associated with the other, and that it almost got to the point of violence, right? And and so, you know, there's a really good reason for this, right? I mean, people talk about tribalism as being a competitive advantage. And, you know, on the one hand, competition improved our evolutionary chances. But, you know, inseparable with that advantage is the competition idea, which is that if you are for your group, you are inevitably going to be against the other group. And what remains of that tribalism is just, we can't not form groups. You know, there's experiments where we put people together, you know, saying with regards to their birth months or whatever, and you'll see this same kind of attitudes and behaviors. It's not something that we can turn off because, again, we're not even conscious that we're doing it. So I guess that's all I'd want to say.
That's helpful because I think it points towards what you offer as a sort of main thesis of how to address this feature, which is the humility character. The humility in the title of your book. So I want to ask you about first of all, how we develop a certain sense of humility in American democracy, but also possibly the inherent tensions that might exist between, as you just suggested. I mean, it's interesting feature about tribalism, that tribalism on the one hand, we've been poo-pooing it in contemporary American democracy, but there's also a way in which you could see benefits to tribalism that it encourages.
Well, at least from an evolutionary perspective, if we weren't, we probably wouldn't be here. If we didn't develop that kind of, and the fact that those of us who have that attitude are here bespeaks the fact that it was a competitive advantage.
Yeah. So do you see that tribal impulse and the humility that you want to develop sort of in tension with one another, or could they be united?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, the tribalism and the bias both are simply there, right? And because these operations within our brain happen at a level that we cannot access, right? We can't say, you know, to our amygdala, would you just knock it off for a minute? I'm trying to, you know, assess this objectively. It just doesn't work that way, right? And so the idea isn't that we can turn this off and be humble. The idea is that if we understand these realities about ourselves, we ought to approach argument and approach our own perspectives with more humility. It's simply a matter of understanding reality better and understanding our own inevitable disconnect from reality. And once we understand this to be universal and inescapable, it should change the way that we approach argument. And that is one thing that I think is not reflected in much of media right now, right? I mean, it is far more likely to be the case that we're going to get our tribalism and our bias reinforced rather than challenged. And so that, I think, is about the way in which I put them together. And I can tell you there is data I think this is in Cordelia Fine's book, A Mind of Its Own, which is a really good book, by the way. She said that if you just tell high school girls, if they're getting a math test, if you tell them, now there is data that girls are particularly anxious about math, and they have a sense that they're not as good at it. And so if you're feeling that, you should understand that is not just you. That's a kind of a pattern in behavior right now. If you tell them that before they take the test, they do better on the test. And so this is a kind of just knowledge gives you a perspective on how you approach politics and disagreement in a way that is that can be useful and can improve our politics. That's at least the claim.
Right. Yeah. I when I think of contemporary media, a lot of contemporary media, it's really the opposite of humility, the kind of smugness that exists, really is that, that all I know it all smugness and a contempt right. for the other side is really the opposite of a sense of the self-effacement or recognition of one's own finitude that's central to humility. Yeah.
So this is the only other thing I want to say about this is, there is a kind of a conception of what humility means that, David Hume he calls it a monkish virtue, and he thinks it just undermines objective thought, right? And there's this notion, especially in Catholic traditions, of, the hair shirt and, mea culpa maxima and all that. That is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, I think the example I point to is Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, who said that humility comes from knowing ourselves as we truly are. So what I'm proposing is an intellectual virtue that, humility is understanding ourselves as we truly are and approaching our arguments and our political fights with that reality in mind. And so, it's not self-abasement, although it does, we don't come off looking great in this regard. Once we understand these things to be true, none of us do. But it's more a matter of just saying, if you understand that you are inevitably and inescapably biased, it should impact how you present your views about the way the world is and what needs to happen.
Yeah, that's helpful. I mean, because I was curious, wanted to get to the discussion about the concept of humility. It's helpful for you to sort of lay that out. I mean, one of the things I was curious about was how humility differs in your view from something like the ancient virtue of moderation. Seems that it is quite different. Maybe, why do you not use moderation? Why humility instead of moderation?
Well, I think because a couple reasons. One, I think it comes closer to sin in that it's inescapable, right? I mean, the operation of bias within our brains, when we hear something that undermines our self-image or our group or goes against our most serious values, our brain kicks in before we are consciously aware of what we have heard. And it's a fairly complex operation in the brain. But the point is that it happens before you're even aware of it. So the idea, this kind of Greek ethos that I am in control and I am, the master of my domain is just not accurate. We can, with effort, ameliorate the effects of bias, but we can't control it and we can't turn it off. And so if that's true, then thinking about it as moderation is just not quite accurate. We should think about it as something that that is going to affect us and going to have an impact on our behavior. And so humility, I think, is a more accurate response to that reality.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it leads to the worry, I think, which you yourself cite in the conclusion, which is, humility, if we become humble intellectually, one of the problems might be is that we might not be able to come to any decision, right? That is, we can become paralyzed by a kind of sense of our own limits. Mm-hmm. And that could, sort of undermine democratic agency. I mean, one of the good things you might say about tribalism is that it sort of engenders great democratic drives. It makes get out there and vote and organize and march and so forth and so on. Whereas humility might lead to the very opposite. So is that a worry for you? And how do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is this kind of notion that, if you are, if you understand all this, if you understand that, none of us have a corner on the market of the truth, et cetera, there can be something kind of enervating about that. I do argue that, with Niebuhr, again, from his Christian point of view, that is, the idea that you are left with no desire to do anything, with no desire to act in the world, that's not legitimate. That is not a worthy response from a Christian. The idea is rather that you are called to act, understanding that you are a fallen creature and that you are not going to get it all right. And I think that is there's something dialectical about that, but I also think that's not a bad perspective for all of us, right? I mean, the political realities are what they are, and we have all of us as being part of the sovereign, right? The people, we have a responsibility to rule, to make decisions. That reality, that responsibility does not end simply because we're unlikely to get it totally right. We have a responsibility to act. Now, is that what gets you to the barricades? No. I mean, I say in the book, no one, storms the Bastille thinking they're pretty sure they're right, or whatever, right? I mean, you are certain, and in the context of politics, it is a sense of anger, outrage, pride. These are the opposite of humility that cause us to act, and that is not an easy row to hoe. There's no two ways about that, right? And Niebuhr talks about that too, that you really do have to be kind of two-faced, that, you're acting as if this is the end of the world if your opponent gets elected, but understanding at some level that it isn't, right? Now, the other thing about humility is that, as with all virtues, and this is, straight out of Aristotle, they are contextual, and the appropriate application of any virtue depends on the circumstance. And there are going to be circumstances in which humility is not the appropriate response. On the contrary, it can be the worst response, right? And so I talk about William Lloyd Garrison and, his attitude about slavery, and he was not humble, and the fact is he was right. Right. And so, I think it is fair, given the condition of our democracy now and the effects of Donald Trump on our democracy, to ask that same question. Is this an appropriate time to be humble? But I also would argue that it's only within a context of knowledge about our own inevitable failings that we are best able to make that judgment. So even when we choose not to be humble, even when we choose to decide that humility is inappropriate for the circumstance, the best way to make that judgment is with a sense of our own humility.
I see. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm curious about on what basis we make that judgment, because it is an interesting question. This is a question that lots of people have made, and that divides people in the Trump era, which is, I mean, should we be humble in the Trump era and have faith in the constitutional liberal order, reduce the kind of partisan polarization, or should we go to the barricades? I mean, I'm just wondering on what basis somebody like Niebuhr would have us judge that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the same calculus that all of us have, right? I mean, there's no obvious answer to that question. And really, there isn't for a lot of people in a lot of nations throughout the world right now. I think if you were to, you know, I mean, the argument that that somebody, I actually quote this in the book, that they were saying that, you know, with the re-election of Obama in 2012, that we are now in a war footing with respect to the future of the nation. You know, I think, you know, from my own political perspective, it's pretty easy for me to, or it's suspect for me to say that that is an illegitimate warlike footing, right? That nothing was that at stake with respect to the re-election of Barack Obama. However, it's also true that, you know, there are people who make that same argument about, you know, right now with respect to Donald Trump, and there, you know, the question is that bringing a knife to a gunfight? And I don't, you know, I don't know how to answer that, and I don't have any kind of strong, you know, or any sense that there's one answer to that that is better than another. I think the only thing we can, I mean, and none of us can predict what the impact of our decision one way or another is going to be, right? I mean, you hear this playing out in the Democratic primary debates even already. But what I would say is that, you know, you don't have the luxury of failing to make that decision because it's difficult or because the outcome is unknown. I think, you know, one way or another, you know, you pays your money and you takes your chances. I mean, you know, you do it deliberately. You do it with an awareness of your own failings intellectually and otherwise. But at some point, you're constrained to act.
Yeah, I mean, let me maybe put it in a slightly different way. The question, I think, you know, there's this recent book by Francis Fukuyama. I think it's just called Identity, which touches on some of the similar issues that you're taking up. But as I understand his book, which I haven't read, but
I haven't read it either. It's not on my list, but there's a lot of books on my list.
The prerogative of academics. We can talk about books we haven't read. This has happened all the time. Anyway, I take it the thesis is that I've heard him on podcasts, so that helps.
Okay, fair enough.
The thesis is that, yes, we have this tribal nature and it can divide us. So, but instead of finding a counterweight to that tribal nature, which is, I take it, what you're doing, it's to extend or expand the tribal sentiment to the country as a whole, to the common, right?
So I actually do say something about that in my section on civic education. I think, you know, we do a terrible job of that, and there's no reason why we shouldn't include this knowledge in you know, our education of how we train future Democrats, small d, obviously. And one of the ways we do that is we can try to use tribalism to include a notion of intellectual humility. So if we were to make part of our tribe the idea that we pride ourselves on our ability to be self-critical or to question those with whom we agree politically. If, you know, that's not simple or obvious or easy, but it is a way to employ our tribalistic tendencies in a way that would be more productive, more positive for democracy. And I don't think that's all that far-fetched. I think, you know, academics, you know, are just, because we're human beings, we are just as susceptible, no less susceptible to these biases than, you know, non-academics. But we do, you know, with respect to the scientific method and other, you know, means throughout every discipline, value and laud self-criticism. And I think that that improves the functioning of the academy. So I don't think it's impossible. I just think it's very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love that idea, the idea of taking pride in one's humility, just the sort of paradoxical character of that is just tickles me. So let's pivot to the sort of institutional suggestions you have in order to foster this humility. And you just talked about education, which is the last chapter that you have on it. So maybe we can go to there and we can come back to some of the other ones. But you could say a little bit about how you think educational institutions, educational curricula can be altered in order to overcome this tribalism, foster some intellectual humility. You have several good, you know, even suggestions for curricular and even sort of pedagogical training or tips for teachers, which are great. So I don't know if you want to, you know, pick any of those and sort of suggest how we might think about education in a different way.
Well, so there's this really interesting experiment that I recount in the book about young men who are, you know, hooked up to fMRI machines and who are viewing pornography. And they tell them, they give them strategies for how to kind of diminish the, you know, the natural effects of watching pornography, right? And so one of them is to try to observe what's going on as a fly on the wall. And so you're literally just trying to divest yourself from the event. And obviously, sometimes in politics, that's very difficult. And when you're in the middle of a heated argument, it's difficult. But it is also a strategy by which we can, you know, turn down the flame on our own anger and self-righteousness. Not to eliminate them, not to take away from our point of view, but just to continue to engage in a way that is not so combative. Because combative dialogue doesn't achieve much. Matter of fact, if anything, it just ups our certainty that we're right and the other person is wrong. So we need to engage in a way that is different from that. And so, you know, because that's difficult, because that's not natural, we need to practice. So I think we should develop, as part of our civic education, give students the chance to argue. And give them the tools by which they can argue more effectively. Fly on the wall is one, and then, you know, there are others that, you know, that I could, you know, talk about too. But you know, and one of them also is that the one I just kind of mentioned of, you know, creating this climate, this tribe in which we all value that skill and that ability. We take pride in it, right? And so, I mean, I think, you know, this would be, you know, the product of a series of experiments, but there have been those kinds of experiments that have been done, and I recount some of them. And I think it is, it's simply not enough to say, all right, students, high school students, here's, you know, Marbury versus Madison. Here's what a pocket veto is. There's checks and balances. There's three branches. Go be a good Democrat. I mean, I just think that's unrealistic and irresponsible on the part of ourselves in terms of training making ready the next generation of democratic citizens. We just need to do more. And if the last 2 years, 5 years, whatever, has taught us anything, it's that we cannot assume that our democracy is just going to continue without our continued vigilance and effort in that regard. And civic education, it seems to me, is one of the most indispensable ways to do that.
Yeah, one of your other suggestions is consider the opposite.
Consider the opposite. That's yeah, one I could not remember. Yes, that's right.
What are the techniques I use in class? Yeah, because I teach a class on left, right, and center, and so we do a lot of debating. And this is one of the techniques I found most fruitful with students is when they get into that sort of tribal combatant mode in class, which all of us, I'm sure, have encountered. I take the time to step back and ask the students who are most tribal to sort of, okay, well, now consider what's the best argument against what you just said,
right?
What is true in what the opponent has said and what's false in it? And you can get them to, I don't know, activate a different part of their brains, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what's happening. You are engaging your prefrontal cortex and you're disengaging, the part that is evaluating this in terms of being a threat. And so you're not turning off the threat. You're not, the threat is still there, but you're pushing your brain in a direction that is more logical, more, less, driven by emotion, less driven by this feeling of being under threat. As I'm sure you can attest, none of this is easy, right? It is literally like, aerobics, it kind of hurts and it takes some discipline and some training, but to the degree that we're able to do this, our fighting is more likely to be fair and more likely to be productive. And, at minimum, we need to be thinking that way with respect to our own behavior and with respect to how we engage young people.
Yeah, and a sizable portion of your book is a couple chapters are about the media and how it sort of feeds into the problem, and it got me thinking about ways to address this problem. One of the things that occurred to me is to ask you about your experience with the podcast that you run, which is Democracy Works, and the or is it Democracy Works or Democracy Works? there's a kind of play on there. In any case, the way in which possibly podcasts could, I mean, they're extremely popular these days. This podcast that I run certainly will not have any democratic effect. It's a sort of academic podcast, but yours maybe can reach more broadly, or others. I mean, other podcasts that you might think of that you think that it could have a salutary effect, or any other sort of ways to address the media problem.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think, the explosion of media opportunities has made it a lot easier for all of us to find information that comports with what we want to be true, with what we understand, the way we understand the world, right? So if you look on my phone, you're going to be quickly surmised that I am left of center, right? And I think that's true for all of us. So, and I don't think podcasts are any different in that regard from any other media, right? I mean, it doesn't change the dynamics of how our brain works and what chemicals we want and what we want to avoid. However, I also think that because podcasts are, there's just so many of them, and because there's such an opportunity to meet any niche, right? Any potential market. And because there's not the demand that there is, the profit, for profit demand that there is in, like, say, MSNBC or Fox News, that there's a niche out there that can be filled by podcasts and by websites and by other media that strive to operate differently, right? That strive to present both sides fairly, and which hold themselves to the standard of of getting it right, right? Of being objective. And so I think it's incumbent on all of us, and I certainly include myself in this, to as citizens, to find those sites, whether it be, you know, BBC. I just had someone yesterday tell me that they thought BBC was better at United States politics than United States politics was because they don't have a dog in the fight, or at least not as much a one, right? And I think that's probably correct. And I think NPR is a lot more scrupulous than, Rush Limbaugh, for example. And I think that's also true with podcasts. I think it is absolutely the case that there are examples out there that in the podcast world that reflect a more responsible, more deliberate attitude with respect to argument. And one I'm thinking about is actually called The Argument.
It's, I was just going to mention that one. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really good. And they don't shy away from it's three people from the New York Times, kind of one middle, one left, and one right. And they don't shy away from their points of view. They don't shy away from arguing, you know, pretty strongly for their point of view, but they respect their opponents as people and as, intelligent observers of the world. And they argue in ways that are reflect that. And so as a result, I think they're more interesting to listen to. And I think there's lots of examples like that. It's just incumbent on us to go find them and you know, to vote with our feet, you know. Mm-hmm. When we interviewed Charlie Dent. Sorry, I just blanked on it. He's a former congressman from Pennsylvania and a Penn State alum. And he said that, politicians are not courageous, they're going to do what they have to do to get elected and reelected. And so if we want to change the condition of American politics, we have to start voting for people who will change the condition of American politics. And that's a really difficult proposition, given the media climate, given the kind of unquenchable tumult that Donald Trump has produced in our politics right now. But the idea that we're going to find it elsewhere, or that we can put the onus on anybody else, I think is just, it's mistaken. It's not going to happen that way.
Yeah, that strikes me as right. I mean, one of the things I at least I'm hopeful about with podcasts is the, we talked a little bit about this before recording, but the length of podcasts, that they're not sort of constrained by the same sort of commercial impulses as, mm-hmm. newspapers or television
or radio, right? I mean, radio. They all have their limits, and they all say, "Oh, we're going to have to end it there." Well, we don't,
and if it constrains thought in that way,
right,
yeah,
exactly. And if it's interesting, and the other thing that Charlie Dent said that I mentioned to you is that, he said it's really nice to be able to genuinely answer a question. Mm-hmm. Right. Because we don't say, wait, no, you got 20 seconds, you know, and that's not to disparage the other media, but it is to say that there are structural advantages to this one. Mm-hmm. And that's one of them. That's a big one. And, there are few problems out there that are not so complex that they couldn't use for, giving people the opportunity to genuinely answer a question.
Let me conclude by asking you about religion, so that, home turf for you, because you have a chapter on religion and in American life, and it's quite interesting. And Niebuhr has this distinction between profane and sacred forms of religion. So maybe we could start by saying what his view about that, what the distinction there is, and why, in your view, we've sort of moved in the direction of embracing more and more of profane forms of religion.
Yeah, so it's profane and profound, right?
Profane or profound.
And, and a profound religion is one that says there's a God and it's not me, and God's will is not my will, and while I can hope that my actions are commensurate with God's will, and while I should, as a believer, strive to make sure that's true, I can never know that that's whether that's true or not. And so, you know, this is not a fairly common quote in the Bible, but Niebuhr quotes it a lot, where he says that somebody calls Jesus good teacher, and he says, "Why do you call me good? There is none good but God alone." And which is an odd thing for the Son of God to say, but there it is. And his argument is that there is this fundamental distinction between us, our will, and God's will. And so we have to operate with that distinction always in our brain. A profane religion is one that sees this very happy coincidence between our interest and God's will. In other words, it sees this connection between the way things are, or if you're out of power, the way things ought to be and the way God wants it to be. So, you know, you see in, you know, you see this throughout history, right? But you know, it is fascinating to go and look at how slaveholders saw their behavior as being exactly what God wants. And it's the gangs of New York where, but right before the big fight at the end, all the leaders of the gangs are shown kneeling and thanking God that, you know, God is on their side, right? Well, not all, they all certainly can't be right. My suspicion is that none of them are. But it is very, very easy for us human beings to see a connection between our own self-interests, our own standing in the world, and God's will. And when we talk about God's will that way, or when we identify our interests with God's will, that is by definition profane. And there is, you know, a natural inclination for us to do that. And a religion is profound when it not only rejects that, but spurns it, condemns it, and forces us to move beyond it. And so there's this bumper sticker that says, "God bless the whole world, no exceptions." That is a profound religion. Mm-hmm. And that is one that that we need, you know, that I think especially Christian politicians must do better to embrace. It's just too easy to see our side as being the side that is God's side.
Yeah, good. And in the book, you talk about, you know, religious groups on the left and the right and how they're turning more in profane, in the profane forms. I wanted to ask you about something slightly different, which has been a concern by some religious commentators, which you don't talk about, which is, you might say, I guess the kind of rise in, you know, the nuns, that is the N-O-N, and yes, no affiliation. Yeah. And also the phenomenon of, I think what the sociologist Christian Smith at Notre Dame calls the moralistic therapeutic deism, that development. I don't know if you've heard of that,
No, I haven't, but that's interesting. I see where it's going.
Yeah. I mean, this is the, what he attributes. I went to Notre Dame to get my PhD, so I don't know him personally, but it's an interesting thought, which is that it's sort of a Tocquevillian thought. I mean, so to back up, I mean, Alexis de Tocqueville has this analysis of American democracy, which is one of his fears is that the direction in which democratic religion is going is towards the destruction of hierarchy within religion, the destruction of symbols and and orders and so forth, and eventually the establishment of pantheism. So the elimination of any kind of transcendence, because that's unequal and non-democratic, and the creation of immanence, and so the identification of God with human beings. And Christian Smith's, you know, he does a lot of these studies with undergrads, and sees in them, when he studies undergrads and sees the religious beliefs, a lot of them are religious in a certain way, which is that they conceive of God as something like somebody who's a self-help guru, right? Who, you know, wants to help them along, but isn't very judgmental, you know, forgives them quickly whenever they do anything wrong, doesn't expect too much out of them. And so that's why he calls them this great term, moralistic therapeutic deism. So I don't know if I, you know, if that sort of rings true to you, or if that's, if that's a concern in your view, and how you fit that within the sort of Niebuhrian framework.
Boy, that's an interesting question, and a complicated one. I mean, I think, you know, Christians are slowly, Christians in America are slowly coming to terms with the fact, to the fact that the former kind of quasi-establishment, at least culturally, of Christianity is waning, if not coming to an end. And that, you know, whereas the United States was an outlier in the first world for decades, that status is declining rapidly. And so, you know, you see with young people and the nuns, you know, the kind of attitudes that you see in, you know, Western Europe, for example. And so, you know, I don't know that that is necessarily a bad thing for Christianity. It may be a bad thing for our culture. It may be a bad thing for, you know, our democracy. But I don't think it's bad for Christians to see themselves as not responsible or not directly associated with the culture. That the demands on them are different, and that they should be living up to that, those differences in their lives. I actually, this is just something I just occurred to me. I haven't thought about this in 20 years, but I was in a conference. The circumstances aren't really important, but this Muslim man said to me, you know, when people ask me to tell them what Islam means, I tell them, look at me, look at my life, look at how the choices I make, look at how I lead my life. That is what Islam is. And my first thought when I heard that was, I bet you there's a lot of Christians who would not be willing to make that same statement. And I think that if Christianity disconnects from this kind of broader cultural affirmation that has been the case for, well, basically since the founding, more or less, I don't know that that is necessarily bad for the faith and for those who profess it.
So the sort of development of agnosticism, I mean, what about the development of a kind of the immanence? I mean, because I take it this is the, I mean, this is an example of what Niebuhr is worried about, the profane, you know, the identification of God and human, you know, that God doesn't really expect too much of us and so forth and so on. He isn't critical. We don't develop that sort of self-critical consciousness that comes along with a more of a traditional religious approach.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I think that's true. And I think there will undoubtedly be, to use a crass term, a market for that kind of perspective and for that kind of church faith experience, right? I think you see that now. I mean, you know, I can think of few things that are less Christian than the gospel of wealth. You know, it makes no sense to me. I mean, it's just completely implausible. However, there are people right now who completely buy in, who think it's completely commensurate with the gospel. Well, Why is that? Because it connects directly to their self-interest, or, you know, how they want the world to be. And so you're never going to develop a state of affairs where that's not the case, and where there are not people who are willing to frame religion in a way that meets people's self-interest. But it would not be bad for Christianity if it were less concerned with that and more concerned with, preaching the gospel in a way that is fully accurate and fully taking on a position that is counter to the dominant culture. And if that means there's less people in the pews, well, that may not be altogether bad, because the people who are in the pews are there for the right reasons. I also think that it's not, just to say that, Christianity, that I'm calling for Christianity to be more accurate, doesn't also mean that it means Christianity is necessarily harsh and judgmental, right? I mean, there's just as much in the gospel about, take on my burden, you who are, burdened and heavy laden, because my yoke is light, my burden is easy. You know, I don't think that I butchered that, but it's pretty close. But I don't know that whatever a genuine Christianity looks like, or how it manifests itself, is necessarily going to turn off people. On the contrary, I think a lot of people are dissatisfied, especially young people, are dissatisfied with the condition of culture right now. And they're dissatisfied with the idea that they need to see themselves as a commodity, primarily as a product of self-branding and, competing in the marketplace, and they're looking for something else. And I think that there's at least an opportunity there for Christianity to fill that void. But, I also have to say that, I don't know what that is, and I don't know how to make that happen. But I think from my reading of the Christian tradition, that certainly seems like something worth trying. I guess that's what I would say.
Well, I think that's a great place to end. I want to thank you again, Chris, for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
My pleasure. Thanks. I really, really enjoyed the questions and the conversation.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us, and thanks to you for listening.